You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs program for Land's Sake. I'm Bill Kite, your host. John Waterman with us. John's been here once before, and he's here today because he has written a new book, very exciting, interesting book, called Chasing Denali. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
This is a book about the subtitle, if you could read that for us. I'm not sure how to pronounce that second name there.
It's the sourdoughs, chechakos, and frauds behind the most unbelievable feat in mountaineering.
All right. Yeah.
Chechakos.
Chechakos. Okay.
Newcomers.
Newcomers. Okay. Greenhorns, as we would call them here
exactly.
In the West. Okay. Or tenderfoots. What prompted you to write this book, John?
Well, these sourdoughs in particular, the main characters I uncover in the narrative, were heroes of mine. And, you know, many mountaineers around the world know the story of their purported climb in 1910 when they claimed to haul a 25-pound, essentially, telephone pole over their shoulders, a flagpole.
Right.
And become the first to climb to one of the peaks of the highest mountain, Denali, on the continent. And I've always been inspired by the pioneers, the people that I literally have followed in the footsteps of. But I wrote this book because I began to realize that what they claimed to do and the reality of it all didn't seem to connect. It hasn't been repeated in more than a century, and there were obviously a lot of lies surrounding what they did and how they did it. And so I wrote the book to unearth the mystery, if you will, and see if they really did it. But also I wrote the book because I have kind of a history with the mountain itself, and I've been, when I returned there in 2016, I'd been going there for 40 years, and it was more than a dozen trips on and around the mountain. So I felt I had more to say about it since I'd already written about it before.
And what's a couple of your books, the titles of those books that you wrote about Denali?
My first book, published in 1983, was called Surviving Denali, which was a study of the accidents, because I was appalled and horrified by the number of people I was hauling off as a ranger when I worked as a park mountaineering ranger on that mountain. And then I wrote two more books immediately following that called High Alaska, which was a kind of a history and a guide to that mountain and two surrounding mountains. And then a book called In the Shadow of Denali, which was a collection of stories about the mountain and about my time there and about the lives of other people lives and deaths of other people whom I was close to.
We talked a little bit about before we went on air how sometimes a place can call us and then we become immersed into that place rather than us seeking it out. How do you feel? Is that what Denali has done for you? It's sort of sought you out?
Very much so. Until a few years ago, I swore I'd never go back, and I hadn't been there since 1993, and I turned to new things, raising a family and conservation work. But I couldn't let go of it, or it couldn't let go of me,
right. Whatever
the case. But there is something in these landscapes that calls to us and in a strange and sometimes undefinable way, particularly remote, wild, desperate landscapes like this, where you really have the chance to see the face of God, you know, where these places are, to many people, might appear empty and desolate, but in fact, without humans there, you have the chance to see something pristine.
There are a lot of places like that seem desolate to a lot of folks, but then aren't, because there's a lot to learn in a place like that. And I think a lot of times we go back to those places to even learn more, to stretch ourselves. You actually had a birthday while you were on Denali when you wrote this book.
Yeah, I was very careful about the whole deal because I had a 60th birthday coming up, and I went back as a volunteer on a Park Service patrol, essentially performing a very similar role to what I'd performed in the 1980s. But I did not expressly go with the idea of setting foot on top on my birthday, but the fates were smiling on me, and I happened to make the summit. Not quite the summit. I stopped a couple of feet shy, like 2 feet shy, because I have a philosophy about conquest in mountains these days, and happened to do all of that on my birthday, my 60th birthday. So I was quite lucky to get that opportunity, moreover, to even have the weather, because climbing that mountain's having the weather.
Pretty treacherous place, isn't it?
Yeah.
It can be. Tell me a little bit more about that conquest, because I was surprised when you didn't, when I was reading the book, and you didn't go all the way to the summit. So tell us a little bit more about that.
I'm glad you asked. The last time I climbed the mountain, I stopped 2 feet short, and that was in 1993. We were making a film. It was kind of an epic production. We had actual film cameras, not digital cameras. So we were hauling cans of film up, and we had climbed it the way the pioneers did, without airplane support, and from the far side as well, coming in by dog sled. And I had this speech prepared for the summit, for just below the summit. And it went something to the effect of, I don't climb mountains to put them underneath my crampon points. I climb mountains because I'm interested in the mountain as a part of a greater ecosystem in the wilderness that surrounds it, and so on and so forth. I managed to talk that way for, I had kind of a script that I'd prepared.
Right.
We were making a 16mm television film. And the way it was shot, not deliberately, but just the way they cut it, made it look like that I was actually standing on the tippity top. And when in fact this whole speech was about not being on top of the mountain, and so I felt betrayed. But that's television work for you,
right?
But I wanted the opportunity to go climb the mountain without really climbing the mountain again, and this time, because I wrote a book about it, I got to hone in on what that philosophy of non-conquest is about. But you know, more simply put, I think that it's easy, as a climber or for athletes in general, to forget that we're not doing these things solely as a athletic endeavor. There's a lot of beauty and respect. Moreover, we go to the mountains to pay homage to them, and to simply put them underneath our feet can be sacrilege. So I'm quite deliberate about this. Although the last time I climbed Soperus, I think I stood... Well, no, I didn't stand on top. Come to think of it, I haven't been to the top.
Right. Neither have I. That's great. I like that. You describe in one place that Denali has the largest vertical rise of any escarpment on the surface of the planet. That's just awe-inspiring. I didn't realize that until I read that. That when you first see that, must really be overwhelming.
Yeah, most people don't have the opportunity to see it from the north, from the more... inaccessible side of the mountain, the Wonder Lake side. And it is a magnificent wall. It basically rises from the tundra at 2,000 feet to 20,000 feet. There's nothing like it. You know, it outstrips Everest easily. There are mountains that have a greater rise if you're counting from beneath sea level, specifically in Hawaii, but there's nothing that outstrips Denali.
This place calls other people that don't make it, that die on the mountain. I didn't know if you wanted to read a section about that, or if that was part of what you wanted to read.
Sure.
Start the book out that way, and it's very commanding the way you start the book out there.
You know, I didn't go up there to get involved in rescues, but it's certainly, I have seen more than a few people that weren't so lucky and lost their lives. And when I went back there in 2016, I yet again was confronted with a corpse, which we had to stamp out a landing pad for this guy. So at the beginning of my book, I picked you out a section from the prologue, is while sitting next to that body bag, waiting for the helicopter to come take it in. I mused about this situation and wrote, "Death on a mountain foils all the best laid plans. If you repeatedly spend time on Denali, it's inevitable, lacking a near miss or even losing a friend, that you'll witness a fatality or help with a body extraction. This can feel like the height of folly, taking on these great tests only to earn such wretched consequences. To continue amid such adversity and to counter the perception that climbing is solely a game of risk addiction, committed climbers also depend upon camaraderie, challenge, the beauty of mountains, and inspirational legends to sustain them through both storm and sunshine. The addiction to risk, with its brain chemistry rewards, never goes away, but can be balanced and put in its corner through mastery and judiciousness. Camaraderie often vanishes outside the intensity of expedition life. Beauty can be as elusive as stormy weather in the high ranges, and even the physical challenge fades as oldsters become incapable of their once youthful feats. With all these shifting and eventually fading motivations, they explain why I stopped mountaineering. I realized that the truly committed could never really quit. I had embarked upon a life path rather than a sport. I had also been following others who had inspired me through what the mythologist Joseph Campbell called, quote unquote, the thread of the hero path." And so this, in effect, begins the following the heroes, i.e. the sourdoughs.
And that's a very interesting story, why you probably chose to write about it. It becomes very interesting. It's hard to put the book down. And the book just came out recently, so if you get a chance, be sure you get it. I think you could probably get it from Amazon. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. And it's called Chasing Denali, and we have John Waterman with us today to talk about his book, and you're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. You mentioned standing on the back of those past pioneers and honoring their legacy, the legend. Tell us a little bit about that, if you could.
Well, I think all too often we forget who came before us, and I've kind of embarked upon and had the luxury to follow in footsteps of pioneers. I've written other books like this, and even if not on book projects, I've had the chance to indulge myself in history. And it's you really can't go to a place like this if people have been there before us and not wonder about what they did and how they did it and the primitive gear that they used and how much more difficult it was. So I've always been fascinated with this history. You know, if you don't study it, as the famous saying goes, you know, we're doomed to repeat this history. So you might as well get to know who your forebears were and how they did it.
Exactly. Exactly. One of the cases you looked at, and speaking of the history, was a fraud, and I think that becomes obvious. I'm not giving anything away here, but Frederick Cook, who was with the Peary expedition, tell us a little bit about this man. Very interesting individual, I found.
Fascinating character. You know, he distinguished himself early on, did the first circumnavigation of the mountain in 1903, and then after a couple of Arctic expeditions, came back and claimed to climb the mountain in its entirety in 6 days from the foot of the glaciers to the top, up a route that in the century that's elapsed has never been repeated. And he went on to commit another huge fraud, trying to convince the world that he made it to the North Pole when he spent, in reality, most of that time in an igloo with his Inuit companions. But the man clearly had great leadership qualities, and in a couple of expeditions anyways before this fraudulent claim on Denali, he really excelled at what he was doing, not only as a adventurer and explorer, but as an ethnologist, and let alone as a physician. He just took the wrong turn somewhere. So to explain the history of the mountain, I think it's important. Again, this is a great example of studying your forebears and figuring out what they did right, and in this case, what they did wrong.
You mentioned leadership, and I find in one area you wrote, to keep the peace, I acquiesce, because real leadership is defined by the ability to follow. So true, isn't it?
Yeah, I've always thought that, and it was even more relevant to me because as a 60-year-old, or as a guy about to turn 60 on this trip, I was surrounded by young bucks, all half my age, more than ever before, I found that following was a good mode with people younger and more outspoken than myself, rather than making waves. And you have a chance as a leader to, you're always going to be called upon. So if you follow, chances are there'll be a chance to step into gear when you're really needed, when real leadership comes into play.
Very, very well said. I tend, whenever I go out on a major expedition, always pick a leader. Something happens, you want the decision made not by committee, but by an individual who's strong enough to carry that leadership to its logical conclusion.
Well, and this was different, too, because this was a Park Service patrol that I was on, so it was important for me to not pretend to know the protocol, even though I had established the protocol 30 years earlier as one of the first mountaineering rangers, and let the designated Park Service leader do his thing.
And his name, not his real name in the book, is Tomato, right?
Well, that's the name we agreed on that we would use. Rather than use his real name,
right,
which he got a kick out of, actually.
You know, the age factor enters in. It's entered in for me quite a bit, having to have a knee replacement and probably a hip replacement as well. Age is something that none of us like to really admit slows us down, but it certainly does. And in the book, it was obvious it slowed you down. And you almost turned back. And I really liked that part because I've been there myself, where the challenge that I accepted seems to be greater than I'm able to accomplish. And I never liked quitting, but there comes a time when turning back does seem like the logical conclusion.
Yeah, I think that the great thing about aging, particularly at high altitude, is there is some evidence to support that as you get older, you lose a lot of your VO2 max, that is your ability to breathe well. Your lungs you don't have the lung power anymore. Mm-hmm. But there is some evidence, and I've read in medical journals even, that people who are older often do better at high altitude. And I actually performed almost as well as I'd ever done before because I'd been sick a lot. So I had that one thing going for me. And there's another part of experience comes, of course, only with age, and being surrounded by younger and extremely fit guys. There's a way to move, and there's a way to carry yourself, not only carry a pack, but move your body, and above and beyond taking the rest step to conserve energy, which I noticed again and again that some of my younger teammates had not yet mastered. So to my surprise, I found an edge there as well.
There's a certain camaraderie, too, that comes with when you put a team together, whether it's on a patrol or whether it's an expedition. Tell us a little bit about that. There seems to be some camaraderie with this group that really kept them together. That the legend is about, and yet it seemed to have fallen apart later on in the book. And so camaraderie is important when you're climbing. If your team's not working right, it's not going to work, is it?
Yeah, in the case of these sourdoughs in 1910, whom you're referring to, there were four of them. It started out, and two of the four were just legendary among miners and trailbreakers of the North in their day. Were known to be able to go long distances without stopping, extraordinary examples of guys who were fit, not because they went to the gym, but because their lives were living bears. They were digging and chopping and hauling and horsing things out of the ground and on their backs. So to them, a climb of a mountain really was quite a straightforward deal. They lived their lives that way. They didn't have to train for this. They just, by virtue of all the time they'd spent in the wilderness, they were superbly trained. But in terms of the camaraderie, they worked together in the mines and on the trail and looked after one another in a way that's only perhaps seen today on expeditions. They did it all the time. But one of them really was a fraud in the kind of way that Frederick Cook was a liar and tried to pull the wool over people's eyes. And unfortunately, the fraud among the four of them was the leader of the expedition. And he was unfit, built like a big pork barrel, and made a big story out of the whole thing. And for many years, it was believed. And so the mystery that I try to unearth is certainly we know the leader didn't make it, but who of the remaining three did, if any of them? And I'm not going to give away the book, but I found some evidence that would allow the reader to make a conclusion about whether they did it or not.
It's a very interesting book. If you get a chance, you want to buy it and read it or check it out at the library, buy it. It would help John, I'm sure. And I appreciated the copy that you gave me, and I finished it pretty fast. What other books are you working on, John? What are you working on right now?
Well, thanks for asking. I am about three quarters through with a massive Atlas of the National Parks for the National Geographic Society. I didn't have the luxury or the budget to actually go to each of these 60 parks, but in the last 50 years, I've been to more than half of them and happened to have worked for a couple of them and spent time in the half of them that I have been to in a fashion that beyond being an ordinary tourist, I just happen to like to go places and paddle and climb and hike and run and ride horses. So I had that to bring to the project. And it's I'm the sole author, but I'm working with a team of cartographers and editors and a lot of expertise in all sort of the beauty of these National Geographic images and the working closely with the Park Service. We have a lot of graphics and maps. And the bottom line is that I took on this project because I'm a lover of national parks, and I thought I would simply be celebrating the parks. But I've come to find that in my research that many of these national parks are in a sad state of affairs, partly because there's an $11 billion budget issue that hasn't been addressed. So there's these just horrendous maintenance issues that exist throughout the national parks that aren't being tended to. But even worse, there are other issues I'm sure that many listeners have heard of: overcrowding in many of the parks, and finally just issues surrounding climate change, whether it's the melting of the glaciers or invasive species such as pine and spruce beetles. The parks are really in a state of transition and really need some help. So to my surprise, I'm writing a book that tries to delicately address these issues and bring them to people's attention while at the same time still celebrating the whole beauty of the national park idea.
Well, thanks, John. I really appreciate that. I'm looking forward to having you in when we get that book out then. That would be
great.
Thank
you. Yeah, I'd love to chat about it.
You've been listening to For Land's Sake, KDNK Public Affairs Program. Whatever you do for Mother Nature, remember to do it for land's sake. Till next time.